Blog Talk Radio.
Some of the earliest recorded music of Louis Armstrong, West End Blues from 1924. Older than even me. Hello and welcome to Sonic Effects. So pleased to have you sitting in with us on this remnant of this start. We're looking skyward in a couple of days here, under the path of an eclipse. Whole areas have declared a state of emergency. It reminds me very much of the feeling that happened when we were pretty sure that the turn of the millennium was going to reset all of the computer chips. Remember that? Not so very long ago. What to do? But for it wasn't quite the panic, because outrage or a surprising event or the tragedy will fall us. We will deal with it just as our ancestors have. As people have forever in our own way, trying to do the best we can for ourselves and others around us, and continue as long as we are viable. Perhaps that's a bit too accommodating, and you'll think, let's put that in. The next thing you know, we'll be handing out saffron robes, selling incense at the airports again. No, there's no mockery here. We have things to consider that will affect us. It came to mind as I was reading a comment on the poet today. The poetry today is Rhodora. It's a poem by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And this happened because it was flipping through work on philosophical poems. And that I got into that because I was reading Goethe's Faust, and you know, just completely absorbed and just so enjoying the delicacy of his writing is just well, anyway, if you haven't read it, you're saving yourself a treat for the last. Get to anyway, the point was, looking at this, one explanation of it just was so beautiful, and I share this with you. I've shared it on one of my sites, but through Meta, I was censored out, being Canadian. He ponders this for its purpose of the rhodora. This is a flower. Does it exist solely for its own sake and not for the benefit of humans? And I thought, what do I do? Thank you, Mr. Emerson, but that's a profound question. It brings it to immediately the point, I think, is to, as you're pondering the beauty of nature, to think about that in your own terms. Do I exist solely for my own sake? And what to do about us when we say, we declare one thing, and yet our behavior, you know, the big reveal, our behavior demonstrates something quite contrary, quite different. Ah, there's the rub, huh? How are we known? We're known by the consistency between what we say and what we do. Because without those, even small, if you want a good barometer, watch the small children. They react. They react to what they can confirm and what they confirm they can trust. You know that the child that won't sit comfortably on a stranger's knee, and I don't mean the children that have been taught that all strangers are a threat. I remember a mother reminded me one day, she brought these two beautiful little girls in for treatment. They would be maybe 4 or 5 years old, maybe, no, a little older, 6. And she cautioned me, as moms tended to do, oh, they're not, they may be frightened by your beard. And that was, she was being, I think her intent was to be very kind. And also exhibiting her own tensions about what these little kids may reveal. You know, children working in psychiatry are always a threat because they're so honest and unencumbered and lovely people. Until I reminded her that our version Jesus had a beard, and our version Santa has a beard, and I went on with a few examples, and in a. And it became apparent to her that she had difficulty. She had difficulty. I hadn't the heart to tell her that the real threat, statistically, the threat to safety of children is predominantly for women in general, it's predominantly within their own families and neighborhoods, people that they know, not the stranger. But it's more convenient to, you know, despots have been, you know, conjuring up that notion that, oh, the stranger is always a threat, isn't it? That person that, especially if they're identifiable on sight, different color, different structure, about different clothing, different food, taste in food, different music. That is a distinction that has been over the centuries conjured up. Conjured into a threat, an identifiable threat. It's fairly easy to play on somebody's anxiety, whip them into a crowd, into a frenzy, and then you want to be the hero to resolve it, as the definition of the despot. Release all of that and target a person that's different. And you often, of course, the minority, you never ever see this done and pointed to a power structure, a very, very powerful structure. Never. It's always the some minority and something that's accessible and something that, you know, that conjures up the idea that they will complain and fight back and say how unfair and unreasonable, but they would say that, wouldn't they? You see the structure of it. It's manipulation. I only bring that up because today we have some of the largest migrations going on and predicted to be even larger that humanity has ever known. People are being displaced by drought, drought and famine and war. Adding to that, economic disparity is certainly adding to that. As my old friend Lindsay pointed out, and I forget, honestly, I forget who he was quoting at the time, that if we build walls around, if we're in the world where there is such disparity, of course people that are living in desperate circumstance will look at those places that has abundance and be attracted to them. And no amount of fence work and walls will stop that magnetism, that draw, that gravity. There's historical examples of this where it doesn't work. It's never worked. And yet here we're seeing that happen. The affluent nations, to share the affluence, we're caught with a bit of a dilemma. You know, I have all these services. I have running water, not just running water, I have hot water and cold water, and I have air conditioning and lighting and paved. My roads are paved, and if there's a ripple in it, we call it a pothole, and we complain, and we pick up our phone and talk to our representative, get that fixed, and it is fixed. And I drive around in my carbon-spewing vehicle and go about my business contributing to the economy and the complexity of the – and I live in this complex environment of rules, so many laws, my goodness. So it's not for the witless to wander through this. And we have that on our in front of us. And I don't know where else to say it, but with people that are reasonable, the existential threat is quite real. What's been mentioned, noticed since the 50s, I think, at least the 50s, collapse of our systems and the effects on the system, we've seen that, and we're still seeing that debate go on. But remember, we still have people who believe that man has walked on the face of the earth with the dinosaurs. And that they age the planet according to a belief system. And right or wrong, it happens. And I believe it happens because it's easier or soothing to hold on to familiar ideas and then to re-examine the basics. I think that's difficult for many, many people to do. Or I could say all of us in a way, in our own way, shape, or form. And all of that hesitance, that reconsideration, it doesn't matter. These changes are happening around us, and whether we like to adapt or not, can we, if we are the creature, the sole creature with reason in this entire universe, with conscience, able to reflect on ourselves, are we at any more of an advantage or disadvantage than creatures relying are creatures of instinct? that do things because of instinct, without apparently caring about their morality. They kill to eat, unlike us who kill to dominate. We happen to be credited as the only species capable of that monstrous ability. But you see that if the things going on around the world, if this global community, global news that's affecting us all, this new wave of accountability that's affecting our politics, isn't enough to be considered important to consider. Then what is? Then it answers the question: do I exist purely for my own sake? Well, apparently I do. If I can just blur out all of those things, those poor migrants, they're over on the shores of Greece and Italy. That's not really a concern for me, that their staging area in Morocco is overrun, or that there's precariously balanced, that they have to put up a military wall around their land to keep these desperate people out. It's easy if you're on a whole other continent separated by 6,000 kilometers of water to ignore that existence until you can only postpone it until we're unable to, and rightly so. We're seeing a migration from the south of people looking for sustainability, and I don't think it's that unusual. Of course, not to be smug, I'm sitting in a country that has working with the idea of immigration is necessary for the prosperity of stability and prosperity of the country for a long, long time. But that's not what you tune in for. It's more about the point. How do we muse, and what do we consider relevant to our purpose, to our needs? What comes to mind? I like simply speaking to the serious side of our mind, that things around us that others take as trivia or just background noise may be revealing things about our environment and our world and ourselves that ought to draw our attention. And I think there's a lot about Freemasonry that's subtle, don't you? I love the subtlety, the understated aspects of our order, that we can do this. We're encouraged to do this without the fanfare. We don't need a parade or a medal on our chest. We do it because, as we're told, it's suggested, it's the right thing to do. Well, Masonry wasn't the first to, it wasn't in the form of Masonry where those ideas came to the likes of me. I consider myself particularly sting in any way. But and I was taught those values. I know that's not widespread. There are many people that will, when they're considering reflecting on what's going on, it will ask themselves before they take initiative, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? And there, do I exist? It raises the question, do I exist solely for my own purpose, not for the benefit of others? I find that curious. Do you? So, I'm thinking about the teetering position of the order. If there is there a teeter? I think this might be a big part of it. Then teaching, reminding or reinforcing the ideas perhaps is a more accurate way of putting things. do we inject ideas? We may paint a more rewarding picture of ideas. We may illustrate these dimensions in the mind. We can take something like charity. Oh, throw a few dollars at a person's begging cup. That's all you need to do. Moralize over it, but don't necessarily do anything about it. Or begin to talk about it. Begin to identify, what is there, 7 levels of charity, I think, and relate to those different levels. In a way, it's like Dante's work on hell, the different levels, and what's saved for the last is the deceitful little rascal and the worst suffering. So if I think we're inclined to go about our work, not because we're all little tin soldiers and we have to fall into step and identify the group with the group think and accommodate the group mind. No, but there is, it's not to be denied that there is a point, there's an effect of ritual, and there's an effect of being part of a large organization and being part of being able to suspend, I think it is a suspension of disbelief. Because the order aims very, very high. The morality and the virtue, those are things that aren't commonplace. You're not going to, you may find them in very common places, but they're uncommon topics. And we strive as much as we can to handle ourselves and those notions that we ascribe to with dignity, with purpose in mind. And we can do that without necessarily declaring that we understand it fully or totally. I don't think we ought to ever consider that it's mum, keep quiet about an idea, because we can't go toe-to-toe with Schopenhauer or Goethe or Kant or Spinoza, with the great philosophies of our time. That isn't the point. It's sorting out our own personal philosophy, our own personal understanding, our own perspective on what's happening around us. Fools like me would declare that is diversity, and that is something that is stabilizing. I like to think that it is. I understand we wander around with notions of tribalism every so often. Our tribe is the one that is best, and all the rest are, oh, well, they poor them. They're not us. And you begin, fine, I guess, until you examine these things, and they fall apart. They're ideas that are built on sand. They just are a little too ego-driven to be useful. Temporary, if you like that kind of thing, I guess people like me will not support it in any shape, but is that to say that it erases that gene pool? Well, nothing's really erased. We have benefited from genetic mutation and the mutation of thinking, and certainly in masonry, it depends on how we look at it. And not to say that it diminishes the value. That type of statement is different when you're looking at a person demonstrating their ability in their own way. That's diversity. And to appreciate and understand the contribution that everybody makes. Well, I suppose your you're all lining up to do a degree in the social sciences. You know, you're going to tuck yourself into understanding these major systems around us and how they affect us and the psychology of our world. Good. Good. I think that might be the point of a lot of the things that we study day by day. And for a little while, can we at least share a little bit of music? I think that would go a long way. And how about a little When Sunny Gets Blue? I think that would be appropriate. Charlie Rose. To begin the show. Top up your espresso or your cappuccino, morning cappuccino, and or your tea or your, wherever you are, your brandy or glass of wine, or your a nice ale. I think the show fits well with a nice ale. And relax. Sit back in your comfortable place and relax with us. A system of morality. Let's see how I do with this today. Were they kidding when they wrote Ritual, telling us masonry is a beautiful system of morality veiled in allegory? Before we arrive at that doorway, we have some miles to travel that will wear out our boots and leave us parched. Of course, we have our own examples of beauty, but beautiful systems of morality? To quote from the Wizard of Oz, that's a horse of a different color. To think in moral terms is hard. I don't believe we are being threaded through the small, tiny hole. But haven't we been reminded that even morality can be displaced by competing to be the most moral in the room? It reminds me of brown shoes. When I walk into a shoe store, the selection seems endless. And I'll admit there are times when I wish on the shelf there was one pair of brown shoes. That I could handle. Are we correct extending our trust to the abstract notions of ancient and accepted? Until we take time to examine and consider them, let alone consider changing our thinking by accepting new ideas, Masonic reflections, we have our own judgment, hopefully doubtful but fundamentally consistent with a virtuous life. As long as we're not expected to change what we do, really. What to do about those who are not like-minded? Nothing. There is nothing to do but to be in character. Carry on silently with life and be the example of a better way. That lets me consider options. Us. I can carry on based on what I've been taught in early life, in my culture, according to my version of a good man, and examine what contributing philosophers have said on the topic. I'm not going to lie to you. There are differences, but at times many of them seem applicable, reasonable suggestions. I can't argue with Hume about religion being a response to fear, but Kant makes sense too. There are limits to human understanding. So reasoning is vitally important. Whether it is his assertion of Hermes Trismegistus or his own, reality is in the mind. And yes, there is evidence of knowledge that happens beyond direct experience. A system of morality. It has such an appeal to be part of that. And yet, it doesn't necessarily define us, does it? If you think about the higher order and ourselves in relation to that, who is that man? How does he live? How does he function? he lives a more, I think he lives a more disciplined or austere or identifiable or understandable life. Is it better than mine? I can't say. I live mine. And does it appear better? Well, everything appears better on a given day, but boys and girls, it's for everything. I've heard, like you, people asserting an answer, they're so sure, and they're ready to dominate the conversation and make their point, only to find that it's fluffy, it's blurred, there's a blurred logic behind it. So it would be nice if it was just the bold and the loud that spoke the truth, and I could just walk out into the multitudes and listen for the most boisterous and the most threatening and say, that must be right just because they carry the biggest threat. But no. We usually find ways of that those folks are overstepping the rules of common dignity and the common good, and they're sanctioned. They're identified, and it's like the people in the French metro who notice a pickpocket and walk around behind them, screaming it out for all to hear, pointing. Isn't that terrible? Don't pickpockets have a right to their privacy? It's a different kind of world of accountability out there, and it's based on, it's coming to us with little machines that help us. Sitting beside me here is a little machine, a little computer, that translates our conversation. No matter, I don't know if it's endless, but we can now converse with each other in our own language. It's not science fiction anymore. And look at what's happening. We're able to smile. And when you see that light, like, oh, we're understanding each other. It's great. Oh, it does. Yes, you're right. It doesn't erase xenophobia, but it makes it a little more, a little less of the primary influence. And there's other questions about this that I think ought not to be asked because they are tremendously impolite. About the minds, but we do know that we have to extract this notion of equality from the world around us. There's so much variation. If I look at the ocean and say it's all just one great big mass, but if I look at it on a small scale, there's these little tiny micro environments. Different chemicals, different compounds, different temperatures, different processes going on. And it's quite overwhelming to think of that happening on a huge scale. But my goodness, there's a lot that overwhelms, and yet we're part of that. No sense throwing our hands in the air, shrieking, oh, it's all too complicated. I'm just going to reject these thoughts. And there are times when we need solace. There are times when we just need that peace and to be able to clear our minds, clear our thinking. If you were of that mind and you were my grandfather, that was walking from the farm out to the first bush and the woods where the work would be. It was always necessary for their work to be done. To be selecting trees for cutting, for harvesting, cutting and split in the winter, and stored for use in the farmhouse, through the cold time, but the peace of mind walking that the dew, the sun coming up. And the dew starting to evaporate in those little clouds of mist as they tend to do. And the sounds, you could hear the birds in the woods. And there's some wildlife running around as usual. But there was a lane, you know, a farm lane that that for horse carts and eventually for tractors, that we would stumble along, and there was crops on both sides. So you could check them out as well. But peace of mind, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. And of course, stumbling along like a short-legged little boy with this great striding, towering fellow beside you, talking and teaching things that were of Masonic value. Who knew? Who knew? Finding the tranquility, that's part of you. That's part of you. And it's one of the resets, a nice way to reset, isn't it? And I suspect some of you, wherever you are, whether you're in Brazil or in Serbia or in the Philippines or Japan right now or Greece or Britain, already realize. Of course, I'm saying things that are self-evident. You don't need somebody necessarily pointing them out, but it is refreshing to be reminded. You can pull back. We are taking note of what's going on around this whole notion of genocide that's brought its ugliness to the headlines again. It is painful. The suffering can be painful, particularly for the empath, to be in one of those rare positions where you're able to do something about it is an important mindset. And as a Mason, we don't qualify our thinking by distance, but by the relevance, by the association of us and to the persons, to individual need. And we form these beautiful networks that are awkward and clumsy and always inadequate, but they are an expression of compassion and concern. And if that, I think that qualifies as a display of higher moral value, don't you? Here's something I think that you'll like. This is a little piece by Cannonball Adderley. Yes, believe that or not. Cannonball Adderley, the late great, and Bill Evans. Thank you. Cannonball Adderley and Bill Evans. Leaving us with a mood. Did it work? Worked here. Now you wander into poetry. You're sitting and relaxing. You have wonderful thoughts in mind. You are a Freemason, and here you experience the best parts, not the tribulations, not the work or the domesticity. You savor. You're just savoring for a moment the finer parts of that. You are part of the order. Oh yes, you may wrestle with what that involves. All of that aside, you are part of the order. And for that, you are part of something bigger, larger than yourself. Here, we don't subject ourselves 24 hours a day, 7 days, nothing extreme. There's nothing about Masonry that works in the extreme. As we know, over the Delphic Oracle, over the temple was two axioms, know thyself and everything in moderation. Makes sense. Even Masonry, everything in moderation. No extremists. So when we're referred to as working philosophers, you know, the practical philosophers, okay, but that doesn't mean we ooze it. We are it. There's times when we stop for a haircut and a shave. We stop at the cafe with our friends. We take those long walks just to absorb the energy from the forest. So we look out at the sun setting on the dunes. We look at the hills around us and feel that it's not confining us, but comforting us. That's us. Here, from George Santayana, the three philosophical poets. This is something that I think, I wish I had had this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's the tie between poetry and philosophy. I like to think, and I will caution you, when you reach my age, you can be honest about these things. I don't care if some schoolboys are mocking, like grow up. It matters so little that people don't necessarily understand. I'm not looking for validation. They just, when I walk around, my thinking is different. And I think it's different. I have an appreciation. I can look at the sunrise, and I can look at trees, and I look at nature around and the patterns of humanity. And there's something different. And it's like a lot of things in Freemasonry, it doesn't really have a word to describe. It's that je ne sais quoi, that feeling, an idea, a thought, that words don't really quickly come to mind to describe it. Oh my goodness, if I can't describe it in words, then it doesn't exist. Really? Really? Here, listen to this. This is his injunction about, Santayana's injunction about philosophy and poetry. And this is from the philosophicalsociety.com. If you haven't dropped it and you're curious about that, it's worth a look. Philosophy is something reasoned and heavy. Poetry, something winged, flashing, inspired. It is the acme of life to understand life. The height of poetry is to speak the language of the gods. And here the article goes on. Just let me share a small portion. It would seem that no two creatures could be more dissimilar than the poet and the philosopher. Who else but a philosopher is disturbed by the deepest questions of meaning and wishes to make a vocation out of solving the knottiest, K-N-O, knottiest problems of truth and knowledge, morals and logic, existence and death. who else but a poet would declare herself, himself, exempt from the strictures of conceptual thought, free to tamper with words to achieve any musical and playful effect her mood requires? The philosopher must be mindful of method and pay careful attention to assertions and evidence and arguments, ambiguities and facts. His work must withstand the most thoroughgoing scrutiny. The poet's work need only be a good performance, entertaining, soulful, humorous, clever. A poem should not mean be. According to Archibald MacLeish in Ars Poetical, ARS, all this sounds about right, and yet some of the most cherished poems happen to have an unmistakably philosophical character. Now get out your crayons in your Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, Lucretius' De Rerum Natura, Dante's Commedia, Goethe's Faust, yay, sitting beside it, Milton's Paradise Lost, there's some interesting courses on that available, and some of the profoundest sages happen to have condensed their thought in poetical form, from the early Buddhists right up to Emerson and Santayana and Khalil Gibran. Any sharp distinction between poet and philosopher must thus be considered problematic. Oh, the rest of the article, you want to talk about Hegel's phenomenology of mind. Well, yeah, but we can do that. But you would have to bring me a glass of Merlot, please. Just have a little tickle here. Then we could get into that. And to be quoting lines of Tao Te Ching, you know, oh, my goodness. I'll leave that for you. But visit, please visit it. Philosophical Poems, you know, you find it in the philosophicalsociety.com. Lovely, lovely, lovely stuff. Here, we're hinting around about Ralph Waldo Emerson. My goodness, this is a lovely man. And this comes from another source that I peer-reviewed academic resource, the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. By all means, my goodness, this is just exceptional. And this is exceptional, so easy to use. Oh, Ralph was born, he went by Waldo, his middle name, 1803 to 1882. And in his lifetime, Ralph Waldo Emerson became the most widely known man of letters in America, establishing himself as a prolific poet, essayist, popular lecturer, and an advocate of social reforms, who was nevertheless suspicious of reform and reformers. Emerson achieved some reputation with his verse, corresponded with many of the leading intellectual and artistic figures of his day, and during an off and on again career as a Unitarian minister, delivered and later published a number of controversial sermons. Emerson's enduring reputation is as a philosopher, aphoristic writer like Friedrich Nietzsche, and the quintessentially American thinker whose championing of the American Transcendental Movement and influence on Walt Whitman, Henry David Thoreau, William James, and others would alone secure him a prominent place in American cultural history. Transcendentalism in America, of which Emerson was the leading figure, resembled British Romanticism in its precept that a fundamental continuity exists between man, nature, and God, or the divine, which is beyond nature is revealed through nature. Nature is itself a symbol or an indication of a deeper reality. In Emerson's philosophy, matter and spirit are not opposed but reflect a critical unity of experience. Emerson is often characterized as an idealist philosopher and indeed used the term himself, explaining it simply as a recognition that plan always precedes action. For Emerson, all things exist in a ceaseless flow of change and being in the subject of constant metamorphosis. Later developments in his thinking shifted the emphasis from unity to the balance of opposites, power and form, identity and variety, intellect and fate. Emerson remained throughout his lifetime the champion of the individual and a believer in the primacy of the individual's experience. In the individual can be discovered all truths, all experience. For the individual, the religious experience must be direct and unmediated by texts, traditions, or personality. Central to defining Emerson's contribution to American thought is his emphasis on the nonconformity that had so profound an effect on Thoreau. Self-reliance and independence of thought are fundamental to Emerson's perspective in that they are the practical expressions of the central relation between the self and the infinite. To trust oneself and follow our inner promptings corresponds to the highest degree of consciousness. Here, if eyes were made for seeing, then beauty is its own excuse for being. Thanks, Waldo. The Rhodora by Ralph Waldo Emerson is a poem that reflects the beauty and significance of the Rhodora flower. The poem's speaker stumbles upon a Rhodora in the woods and is struck by its beauty and fragrance. The speaker ponders the flower's purpose and reflects on the idea that it exists solely for its own sake. Despite its small size and insignificance, the speaker sees the Rhodora as a symbol of the power and majesty of nature. In the end, the speaker concludes that the flower is a reflection of God's love and grace, and that its beauty serves to uplift and inspire all who behold it. In this poem, Emerson celebrates the beauty and wonder of nature and encourages readers to see the world with a sense of awe and reverence. Not short, maybe 20 lines. I'm being asked, whence is the flower? In May, when sea winds pierced our solitudes, I found the fresh Rhodora in the woods, spreading its leafless blooms in a damp nook to please the desert and the sluggish brook. The purple petals fallen in the pool made the black water with their beauty gay. Here might the from his plumes to cool and court the flower that cheapens his array. Rhodora, if the sages ask thee why this charm is wasted on the earth and sky, tell them, dear, that if eyes were made for seeing, then beauty is its own excuse for being. Why thou wert there, O rival of the rose, I never thought to ask. I never knew. But in my simple ignorance, suppose the same selfsame power that brought me here brought you. Brought you. Thank you. John Coltrane. Whew. Now, the history corner. Here we're comparing lodges a long time ago, but lodges that perhaps reflect some of the mechanics or the energies being exhibited in lodges around us, but at a safe distance so we can consider it without drawing on our own, our own egos or our own investment in, being right all the time. Safe distance, same distance. Here, when we're looking at what's unique about them, but it also is a lesson in what's in the perspective, changing perspective. As Margaret Jacobs says, what is unique about these Strasbourg lodges is their social segregation. Behind the closed doors of the lodge, ideology and rank are fitted together neatly in ways that would not have been possible if the lodge had mixed the titled and untitled. In each of the lodges at which we are looking, the social content of the discussion is markedly different. Almost certainly, we're seeing a long-standing class antagonism dating back to the time when Le Candeur had objected to the social composition and hence the regularity of Saint-Genevieve. Writing in 1765, a brother put it thus, if the brothers of Le Candeur had treated with less haughtiness all of those whom they believe are not their equals in the civil estate, there would certainly be fewer irregular lodges. And in obvious irritation, Le Candeur never forgets to say that Saint-Genevieve is composed only of merchants. You will see that, except for five, all who compose it are bourgeois. It remains to be seen shortly how Le Candeur expresses its social identity. None of the values expressed in the orations given at the creation of the new lodge would have been complete without rituals. After having brought to the altar the venerable master a silver warming dish filled with hot coals, the master places another on it, thus signifying the purification of the new lodge, and then prays to the grand architect of the universe, you, who guides our writings, who knows the plans that we have traced for the construction of our august temple. Each brother of the new lodge approaches the altar and gives allegiance to the Grand Lodge by placing a hand on the Book of Constitution. In the name of the Grand Orient of France, the Lodge des Beaux-Arts is installed. After much applause, the master places the letters of patent from the Constitution in the sanctuary to the right of the throne in a frame prepared for that purpose. In this ritual, the constitutional has become the sacred. Time we are reminded of that occasionally. The sacred. Seems like we're tampering with things again. My goodness. My goodness, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. That whole notion. Here, Dexter Gordon will help. Goodbye. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is the end of another episode of Masonic Effects. The fact that Masonry is you, the fact that you are the temple, that you are the one attempting to ascend that ladder to find and experience and be the divine, that suggests to me this is a rare group in the human landscape. And perhaps there are millions like us. Perhaps there are. And perhaps there are millions more that haven't declared or identified. Perhaps we are just that fortunate to have found our way to the Masonic Order and to be putting it together, comparing, of course, and wondering about these notions of inconsistency, you know, how we see that we have a way that's very comforting and clear, but others don't. They don't agree with us. And usually it's somebody that's transparent as a nervous person or somebody with a neurosis that needs to attempt to imagine this in a philosophic environment, needing to assert your personality. But it does happen. Come on. You've been in those departments. You know what I mean. And they generally isolate themselves, don't they? To have your company, the company of somebody like-minded, is a privilege. I hope you'll not underestimate that. Nor will you feel that somebody else's efforts are determining your emotional well-being. They don't need to. You don't deserve that. You are in control of your thought and emotion. If you put your mind to it, it's all mentalism. Thank you very much for showing up and being part of this again. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness again. My goodness, the world needs it, doesn't it? And include yourself. The charity and generosity you show to others probably deserve to more so to the harshest critic of you, which happens to be you. I'll see you again in a few days. Thanks, one and all.